Hitler's War by David Irving. First Lady. At one end of that broad Munich boulevard, the Ludwigstrasse, is the Victory Arch. At the other, the grimy stone Feldherrenhalle mausoleum. Here, unsuspected by the silent crowds lining the icy sidewalks as dawn rose on December 22, 1937, Nazi Germany had jolted imperceptibly onto the course that was to lead it to ultimate ruination. It happened like this. General Erich Ludendorff, Hindenburg's old chief of staff in the Great War, had died, and his simple oak coffin was lying in the shadow of the Victory Arch, draped with the Kaiser's colors, and flanked by tall, black-shrouded pylons topped with bowls of lingering fire. High-ranking officers of the new Wehrmacht, the armed services, had stood stiffly frozen all night at each corner of the bier, carrying on silken cushions the 80 medals that the departed warrior had earned. Hitler had arrived just before 10 a.m. Werner von Blomberg, newly promoted to field marshal, had thrown his arm up in salute. General Hermann Göring, the Luftwaffe's commander and most powerful man after Hitler and Blomberg, had followed suit. The army's commander, Baron Werner von Fritsch, was still in Egypt on holiday. To the thud of muffled drums, six officers had hoisted the coffin onto a gun carriage. The photographs show Hitler walking alone and ahead of his commanders and ministers, bareheaded, his face a mask, conscious that 100,000 eyes were trained on him. This, he knew, was what his people wanted to see. Their Führer, followed by his faithful henchmen, surrounded by his subjects, united in a common act of spectacle and grandeur. As the last melancholy strains of the faithful comrade died away, a 19-gun salute began from the battery in the Hofgarten, scattering indignant pigeons into the misty air. Hitler left with his adjutants for the courtyard where the cars were waiting. Here Blomberg approached him, quote, "Mein Führer, can I speak somewhere with you in private?" unquote. Suspecting nothing, Hitler invited him to his private apartment. Within 5 minutes, he was in the elevator at number 16 Prinzregentenplatz. Here, Blomberg asked Hitler's permission to marry again. His fiancée was of modest background, a secretary working for a government agency, but this was not what was this not what National Socialism was all about? Hitler gave his consent immediately. With Blomberg, Hitler had established close rapport. Both he and Göring agreed without hesitation to act as witnesses at the wedding. The ceremony took place in private at the War Ministry on January 12, 1938. The bride was 24, while Blomberg was nearly 60. She was undoubtedly attractive. She was slim, with fair hair, a broad forehead, gray-blue eyes, a petite nose, and a generous mouth. The couple departed immediately on their honeymoon, not knowing that their lopsided marriage would later be construed as having set Hitler on the final approach to absolute power. Their honeymoon was soon interrupted by the unexpected death of Blomberg's mother. Blomberg's chief of staff, General Wilhelm Keitel, accompanied him to her funeral on January 20th at Eberswalde, 30 miles from Berlin. When the field marshal returned on the 24th, some disturbing news must have awaited him, because he immediately applied for an urgent audience with Hitler. Hitler had returned to Munich briefly to open the Great Arts and Crafts exhibition there. When his car drew up outside the Berlin Chancellery late on January 24th, he found Göring waiting with a buff folder in his hands. Quote, "Blomberg has married a whore," unquote, Göring announced. Quote, "Our new First Lady has a police record. He tricked us into acting as witnesses," end quote. What had happened in Blomberg's absence was this. 3 days earlier, on January 21st, the police president of Berlin, Count Wolf von Heldorf, had shown to Keitel an innocuous change of address record card and asked if Keitel could confirm that the lady in the photograph was the new Frau von Blomberg. Keitel, however, had only seen her at the funeral, heavily veiled. He had suggested that Göring be asked, as he had been at the wedding. Heldorf had explained that something of the woman's past had come to light now that she had routinely registered her change of address to Blomberg's apartment in the War Ministry building. He had visited Göring the next morning and given him the complete police dossier on Fräulein Eva Grün, as she had been before her marriage. As Hitler opened this buff-colored dossier now on January 24th, a collection of file cards, photographs, and printed forms met his eyes. There were fingerprint records, wanted posters, and a half-dozen photographs showing a woman in various sexual poses with a wax candle. The police background statements yielded a stark mirror image of a Berlin society in the grips of economic crisis. Fräulein Grün's father had been killed in the war when she was 5 years old. Her mother was a registered masseuse. In 1932, Eva had left home at 18 and moved in with her lover, a Czech Jew of 41, one Heinrich Lovinger. Later that year, he had been offered pornographic photographs, and it had struck him that this was easy money. He had hired a Polish photographer, and the pictures were taken one Christmas afternoon. Lovinger had sold only 8 when he was pulled in. The only other items in the dossier were search notices relating to her having left home while underage, and a 1934 police data card which clearly states that she, quote, had no criminal record, unquote. According to the dossier, she had last visited her mother on January 9th with her future husband, quote, and we all know who that is, unquote, somebody had scribbled in the margin. As he turned page after page, Hitler became visibly angry. Hurling it back at Göring, he exclaimed, quote, is there nothing I am to be spared, unquote. Hitler was stunned that Blomberg could have done this to him. Clearly, as Göring now said, the field marshal would have to resign. But who could succeed him? Heinrich Himmler, the all-powerful Reichsfuhrer of the black-uniformed SS, was one candidate. So, of course, was Göring. First in line, however, was General von Fritsch. In his confidential handwritten notes of these dramatic weeks, which were removed from Potsdam to Moscow in 1945, Fritsch denied any ambition to succeed Blomberg. Quote, I would have refused such an appointment, since, in view of the party's attitude toward me, the obstacles would have been insuperable, unquote. Hitler had a deep regard for Fritsch, but there was one worrisome skeleton in the cupboard. It could be ignored no longer. 2 years earlier, during the 1936 crisis of Hitler's remilitarization of the Rhineland, Himmler had shown to him a police dossier linking Fritsch with a homosexual blackmailer. At that time, Hitler had refused to look into it, but the allegation obviously festered in his brain. Quote, at the end of March, or early in April 1936, unquote, General von Fritsch was to write 3 years later, quote, I invited the Führer to do the army the honor of becoming honorary colonel of the 9th Infantry Regiment at Potsdam. The Führer accepted, and the regiment was to march to Berlin for the purpose on April 20th. On April 19th, Hossbach, Hitler's adjutant, phoned me that the Führer had withdrawn his agreement to become colonel of the 9th Infantry Regiment. End quote. At the time, this was a baffling mystery to Fritsch. On Hitler's birthday the next day, he had sent him a telegram from his sickbed at Ockerberg. Quote, the army and I follow you in proud confidence and willing faith along the path you were marking out ahead into the future of Germany. Unquote. On January 18th, 1939, Fritsch commented, quote, that was absolutely true at the time. Today I haven't any faith at all in the man. How far the Army's officer corps has faith in him, I cannot surmise. End quote. By 1939, of course, he knew why Hitler had withdrawn his acceptance. Quote, it was in the spring of 1936, he wrote, that Himmler first furnished to the Führer the dossier claiming I had been blackmailed. Perhaps that's why the Führer withdrew his agreement to become colonel. His later explanation that the party would never understand his becoming colonel of a regiment wasn't very likely, or at least not acceptable. The following is also possible. Himmler finds out that the Führer wants to become colonel of the 9th Infantry Regiment. He fears this may strengthen the army's influence even more. This he wants to thwart. That rascal Himmler is absolutely capable of such a deed. End quote. As recently as December 1937, while Fritsch was still in Egypt, Himmler had again brought up that dossier and stressed the security risk involved if Fritsch was a homosexual. Hitler had suspected that the party was just settling scores against Fritsch, however, and had demanded its destruction. Since Fritsch's return, Hitler had not seen him except once on January 15, 1938, when they had a two-hour argument. Fritsch described it thus, quote, "The Führer angrily began talking about his worries at the spread of anarchist propaganda in the army. I tried in vain to calm him down. I asked for concrete evidence. The Führer said that he did have such material, but he could not give it to me, only to Blomberg. In other words, an open vote of no confidence in me. I had no intention of leaving it at that. I planned to ask the Führer for his open confidence in me, failing which I would resign. But it never came to that." End quote. Now, on January 24th, the shoe was on the other foot. Hitler decided to have it out with Fritsch. He told an aide to summon the Wehrmacht adjutant Hasbach by telephone. The colonel was in bed, however, and stubbornly declined to come before next morning. Hitler lay awake until dawn, staring at the ceiling and worrying how to avoid tarnishing his own prestige if this double scandal ever became public. The next day, January 25th, Goering reported at 11 a.m., that he had seen Keitel and instructed him to have a talk with the unfortunate war minister about his bride. By early afternoon, he had been to see Blomberg himself, he reported, and told him that he must resign. Goering related to Hitler that the minister was a broken man. In Hasbach's presence, Goering now furnished to Hitler the Gestapo dossier on the homosexual link to Fritsch's name in 1936. The folder was evidently a recent reconstruction containing several carbon copies of interrogations, affidavits, and photostats. A certain blackmailer, Otto Schmidt, had been arrested in 1936 and had then recounted the homosexual exploits of one, quote, General von Fritsch, unquote, as witnessed by himself in November 1933. He had introduced himself as, quote, Detective Inspector Kroger, unquote, and threatened to arrest him. The general had produced an army ID card and blustered, quote, I am General von Fritsch, unquote. He had bribed Schmidt with 2,500 marks collected from his bank in the Berlin suburb of Lichterfelde. As Goering contentedly pointed out to Hitler, Schmidt's evidence had proved true in 60 other cases. The dossier, in short, was damning. Even so, Hitler was uncertain. He ordered Goering to question Otto Schmidt in detail, and he forbade Hasbach to mention the matter to Fritsch. Unfortunately, Hasbach that same evening confided rather incoherently to Fritsch that allegations had been made about improper behavior with a young man in November 1933, and this incomplete prior knowledge was to have fateful consequences for Fritsch. He concluded that a certain member of the Hitler Youth was behind the complaint. In 1933, he had arranged for one young Berliner, Fritsch Vermelskirch, an apprenticeship at the Mercedes-Benz factory at Marienfelde. The youth had then turned to crime, however, and when he bragged to underworld friends that he had a high-ranking benefactor, Fritsch had severed all connections with him. That had been 3 years ago. The next morning, Hasbach admitted to Hitler that he had warned Fritsch. The general had hotly rejected the allegation as, quote, a stinking lie, unquote, and he added, quote, if the Führer wants to get rid of me, one word will suffice and I will resign, unquote. At this, Hitler announced with evident relief, quote, then everything is all right. General von Fritsch can become minister after all, end quote. During the day, however, rival counsels prevailed. Blomberg was ushered into Hitler's library in plain clothes. He angrily criticized the manner in which he had been dismissed. Then ire gave way to sorrow, and Hitler, who genuinely feared that Blomberg might take his own life, tried to console him. He hinted that when Germany's hour came, he would like to see Blomberg at his side again. The discussion turned to a successor. Hitler commented, quote, Goering has neither the necessary perseverance nor the application, unquote. As for Fritsch, said Hitler, there was some belief that he was a closet homosexual. To this, Blomberg evenly replied that he could quite believe it. Thus, the word of the commander-in-chief of the German army came to be tested against the utterances of a convict. His accuser, Otto Schmidt, by now aged 31, pale and puffy from years of incarceration. Late on January 26th, Fritsch was summoned to the library. He himself wrote this hitherto unpublished account of the famous scene. Quote, "I was evidently called in at about 8:30 p.m. The Führer immediately announced to me that I had been accused of homosexual activities. He said he could understand everything, but he wanted to hear the truth. If I admitted the charges against me, I was to go on a long journey, and nothing further would happen to me. Goering also addressed me in a similar vein. I emphatically denied any kind of homosexual activities, and asked who had accused me of them. The Führer replied that it made no difference who the accuser was. He wished to know whether there was the slightest basis for these allegations." Unquote. Fritsch remembered Wermelskirch. Quote, "Mein Führer," he replied, "this can only be a reference to that affair with a Hitler youth." Unquote. Hitler was dumbfounded by Fritsch's answer. Otto Schmidt, the man in the Gestapo dossier, was no Hitler youth. Hitler thrust the folder into Fritsch's hands. The general rapidly scanned it, purpled, and dismissed it all as a complete fabrication. At a signal from Hitler, the blackmailer was led into the library. Schmidt pointed unerringly at the general and exclaimed, quote, "That's the one," unquote. Fritsch was speechless. He blanched and was led out. Hossbach urged Hitler to give a hearing to the General Ludwig Beck, the chief of general staff, but the very telephone call to Beck's home at Lichterfelde stirred fresh suspicions in Hitler's tortured mind. Had not blackmail money been collected from a bank at Lichterfelde? Later, he interrogated Beck about when he had last lent money to his commander-in-chief. The puzzled general could only reply that he had never done so. Fritsch's own pathetic story continues, quote, "I gave the Führer my word of honor. Confronted with the allegations of a habitual crook, my word was brushed aside as of no consequence. I was ordered to report to the Gestapo next morning. Deeply shaken at the abruptness displayed by the Führer and Goering toward me, I went home and informed Major Kurt Seward, personal chief of staff, in brief about the allegations. Soon afterward, I was informed General Beck. I also informed General Beck." That's what he meant. "I mentioned to both that it might be best for me to shoot myself in view of the unheard of insult from the Führer." Unquote. Fritsch demanded a full court-martial to clear his name. Who should succeed Blomberg now? Goebbels suggested that Hitler himself should do so. Sent for again the next morning, January 27th, Blomberg pointed out that since President Hindenburg's death, the Führer was constitutionally supreme commander of the Wehrmacht already. If he appointed no new war minister, then he would have direct control of the armed forces. Quote, "I'll think that over," replied Hitler. "If I do that, however, then I'll be needing a good Wehrmacht chief of staff." Unquote. Quote, "General Keitel," suggested Blomberg. "He's done that job for me. He's a hard worker and he knows his stuff." End quote. As Blomberg, now in plain clothes, left the chancellery for the last time, he noticed that the sentries did not present arms to him. At 1 p.m., Hitler received Keitel, a tall, handsome general of unmistakably soldierly bearing, although he had been told to come in plain clothes. He had headed the Army's organization branch during the recent expansion. He was a champion of a unified Wehrmacht command. Hitler asked him who ought to succeed Blomberg, and Keitel, too, offered Goering's name. Quote, "No, that is out of the question," replied Hitler coolly. "I don't think Goering has the ability. I shall probably take over Blomberg's job myself." End quote. He asked Keitel to find him a new Wehrmacht adjutant to replace the disobedient Hossbach. Keitel picked Major Rudolf Schmundt. Hitler, Keitel, Schmundt, the links of the historic Wehrmacht command chain, were coming together. Over the next link, Fritsch's position, I'll get it, that question mark still hung. As Hitler had ordered, General von Fritsch submitted to Gestapo interrogation that morning, January 27th, 1938. Concealed microphones recorded every word, and the 83-page transcript has survived, revealing the drama as the monocled Baron was again confronted with the sleazy blackmailer. Schmidt stuck to his filthy story, despite the sternest warnings from Werner Best on the consequences of lying. The general he had seen in 1933 had smoked at least one cigar during the blackmail bargaining. He again described the alleged homosexual act. Quote, "This Bavarian twerp," referring to the male prostitute Weingartner, "was standing up and the man knelt down in front of him and was sucking at it," unquote. To which Fritsch could only expostulate, quote, "How dare he suggest such a thing? That is supposed to have been me," end quote. He conducted part of the questioning himself. None of Schmidt's details fitted him. He had not even smoked a cigarette since 1925. He frankly admitted that the evidence seemed damning. Quote, "I must confess that if pressure has been brought to bear on him from some quarter or other to tell a lie, then he's doing it damnably cleverly," end quote. Two other quote-unquote witnesses had been posted unobtrusively in the Gestapo headquarters where they could see him. Weingartner, the male prostitute, was emphatic that this was not his client of 1933. Booker, Schmidt's accomplice, detected a certain resemblance, but would not swear to it. Hitler was not informed of this ambivalent outcome. Quote, "If the Führer had only been told of these two facts," Fritsch later wrote, "then his decision would surely have been very different, in view of the word of honor I had given him," end quote. Quote, "It's one man's word against another," observed Goebbels in his diary, "that of a homosexual blackmailer against the army's commander-in-chief," end quote. The next day, he recorded that, although Heydrich had conducted several quote-unquote all-night interrogations, Fritsch was standing up to him. Hitler, however, had already written off Fritsch. On January 28th, he was already discussing a short list of possible successors as commander-in-chief army. His first choice was General Walter von Reichenau, Keitel's predecessor at the War Ministry. Keitel advised against him. His own candidate was General Walter von Brauchitsch, a stolid, widely respected officer whose reputation was founded on his period as army commander in East Prussia. In fact, Keitel had already telephoned him urgently to take the next train from Dresden. He arrived at 8:45 that evening. Next morning, Keitel repeated to Hitler the answers given by the general under close questioning. In particular, Brauchitsch was willing to tie the army closer to the Nazi state. Hitler sent for Brauchitsch. Now the general mentioned, however, that he too had delicate personal difficulties. He wanted a divorce to marry a Frau Charlotte Rufer, herself a divorcee. His first wife must be settled financially, which he could not afford. Brauchitsch's nomination thus appeared to have foundered. The jostling for Fritsch's office resumed. Reichenau was seen haunting the War Ministry building. Goering sent his loyal aide, Colonel Karl Boldenschatz, to drop hints amongst Hitler's adjutants that Goering ought to take over the army, too. Admiral Erich Raeder, the Navy's commander-in-chief, sent an adjutant to propose the revered but cantankerous General Gerd von Rundstedt as an interim tenant for the job. Hitler rejected all of these contenders. He heaved the weighty army list volume across the desk to the Navy captain and challenged him, quote, "You suggest one," unquote. On February 3rd, Hitler reluctantly declared himself satisfied with Brauchitsch's attitude on the church, the party, and military problems, and formally shook hands with him as Fritsch's successor. The unfortunate General von Fritsch was asked that same afternoon by Hitler to submit his resignation. Fritsch wrote later, quote, I accepted this demand, as I could never have worked with this man again, end quote. On February 4th, Hitler accordingly signed an icy letter to Fritsch, formally accepting his resignation, quote, in view of your depleted health, unquote. The letter was published, thus driving the last nail into Fritsch's coffin, as it turned out. Meanwhile, Hitler had charged Dr. Hans Lammers to negotiate the terms of a financial settlement for the first Frau von Brauchitsch to agree to a noiseless divorce. Eventually, the Reich settled an allowance of about 1,300 marks a month on her. Hitler thereby purchased complete moral sway over the army's new commander-in-chief and for a relatively paltry sum. Hitler, Keitel, Schmunt, Brauchitsch. The chain of command had gained another link. Hitler decided that Brauchitsch, Goering, and Raeder, as the three service commanders-in-chief, would take their orders from a new supreme command authority, the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, OKW.
with Wilhelm Keitel as its chief of staff. Hitler himself would be supreme commander and the new OKW as his military secretariat. This OKW would also exercise Blomberg's former ministerial functions. His old National Defense Division, the Abteilung Landesverteidigung, would transfer to the OKW as an operations staff, commanded by Colonel Max von Biban. Max von Biban, there we go. A staff officer of the older generation. Thus, Keitel himself became Hitler's principal military secretary. Hitler never regretted the choice. The general's métier was a willingness to obey. At most, Hitler needed an industrious and efficient machine to put his own military policies into effect. He confided to Keitel that he was planning to do something that would make Europe, quote-unquote, catch its breath. It would also serve to distract attention from the Wehrmacht's problems. He would carry out a general top-level reshuffle to give the impression not of a momentary weakness of a gathering, not of a momentary weakness, but of a gathering of strength. It was indeed a minor landslide. Hitler changed his foreign minister and minister of economics. Inconvenient diplomats like Ambassador Ulrich von Hassel in Rome were forcibly retired. Goering was promoted to a field marshal, while 70 army and Luftwaffe generals were too old, conservative, or obstinate, were axed or transferred. Keitel's younger brother became chief of army personnel. Most of the dumbfounded victims first learned of these changes when they opened their newspapers the next morning. By February 5, 1938, Hitler knew that his tactics had largely succeeded. The British press, Lord Rothermere, telegraphed him, quote, "May I add, my dear Führer, my congratulations on the salutary changes you have made. Your star rises higher and higher," end quote. The German army, however, could not be so easily fobbed off. Fritsch's disposal was seen as evidence of the hold that the party was gaining. At 4 p.m. on February 5th, Hitler delivered to his leading army and Luftwaffe generals standing around him in a semicircle in the War Ministry a 2-hour speech in which he mercilessly recited the allegations that had resulted in the resignations of both Blomberg and Fritsch. He read out the formal legal opinion of the Minister of Justice and quoted choice extracts from the Otto Schmidt dossier. At 8 o'clock that evening, Hitler presided over what was, as things turned out, the last cabinet meeting ever called. He briefly introduced Keitel and Brauchitsch. The former would faithfully administer the Wehrmacht High Command until the end of the coming war in 1945, while the latter proved a complacent army commander-in-chief only until December 1941, when he and Hitler parted. After the cabinet meeting, Hitler set out for his mountainside home in Bavaria as Führer, Reich Chancellor, and now Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, in fact as well as name. Quote, "The damage that one woman can do," exclaimed Goebbels in his diary on February 6th, "and that kind of woman, too," end quote. Yet if these scandals had proven anything, it was that Adolf Hitler was more deeply in the thrall of his devious henchmen than even he suspected. By early March, when he was back in Berlin, the first whispers were reaching him that he had been misled. The SS had willfully deceived him, and even Goering might not have been entirely above blame. Hitler evidently ignored the rumors. Fritsch was now lost beyond retrieval, while Himmler, the SS, and Goering were indispensable. The army investigators began their inquiries in February. Fritsch engaged a gifted barrister, Count Rüdiger von der Goltz. On March 1st, Goltz succeeded in establishing that the blackmailer Schmidt had witnessed not Fritsch, but only a cavalry captain of a similar name, Achim von Fritsch, without the T. The latter very commendably admitted the felony. To clinch it, he even produced Schmidt's signed receipt for the 2,500 marks that he had been paid. Disturbingly, he also revealed that the Gestapo had investigated his bank account at Lichterfelde as early as January 15th. It was pure coincidence that this was only 3 days after the Blomberg wedding. General Walter Heitz, representing the Army Tribunal, took his startling evidence to Hitler on March 3rd. Hitler's first impulse was to call off the impending hearing. Heinrich Himmler was present, however, and he interjected,
quote, "The Fritsch and the Frisch cases are two entirely different matters. The blackmailer, Schmidt, has himself identified the general," end quote. To underline this particular point, Achim von Fritsch was now also arrested since he had confessed to homosexual offenses. Hitler ordered the Fritsch trial to begin in secret on March 10th. A few days later, Fritsch himself wrote, quote, "Initially, my impression was that Goering, who presided, was working toward an open verdict. In other words, that my guilt had not been established, but that it was still possible. The weight of evidence was so great that even Goering had to announce that no reasonable person could fail to be convinced of my innocence. Finally, the key witness, the blackmailer, confessed that everything he had said about me was a lie." And end quote. During the hearings, it came out that on the very eve of the trial, the head of the Gestapo's homosexual investigations branch, criminal rat Joseph Meisinger, had threatened Schmidt with a sticky end should he recant on his sworn testimony. Fritsch was acquitted. There was no evidence that Hitler concerned himself in the least with the unbecoming background of this Gestapo intrigue. It was one of Meisinger's officials who had checked the Lichterfelde bank account in January, so Meisinger at least realized the error he had made. Shortly after the trial began, Himmler sent him out of harm's way to Vienna. His career was unimpaired by the blunder. Not so the career of General von Fritsch. On the day after his acquittal, he wrote to his lawyer, quote, "Whether and to what extent the Führer will allow me to be rehabilitated still remains to be seen. I fear he will resist it with all his might. Goering's closing remarks would seem to indicate this in part." End quote. In his private notes, Fritsch recollected, quote, "Both before the end of the examination of the witnesses and while reading the tribunal's verdict, Goering took pains to justify the Gestapo's actions. He admittedly spoke of the tragedy of my plight, but said that, under the circumstances, it could not be helped. Throughout it all, you could hear the leitmotif, quote, 'Thank God we've got rid of him, and he can't come back,' unquote." Goering kept referring to me with emphasis as Colonel General von Fritsch retired, end quote. Not until Sunday, March 20th, could General von Prauchitsch obtain an interview with Hitler to demand Fritsch's rehabilitation. Quote, "The Führer was apparently not entirely opposed to rehabilitating me," wrote Fritsch later, and end quote. He drafted a 12-point list of the facts pointing to a Gestapo intrigue. At the end of March, he incorporated them in a letter to Himmler. It ended with the extraordinary words, quote, "The entire attitude of the Gestapo throughout this affair has proven that its sole concern was to brand me as the guilty party, and I therefore challenge you to a duel with pistols." End quote. He asked first Beck and then Rundstedt to convey the letter to Himmler as his seconds. Both of these stalwarts politely declined. Under pressure from Prauchitsch, Hitler did take a sheet of his private gold embossed notepaper and write sympathetically to Fritsch. I was scrolling past a picture here. Hold on. There we go. The general replied with a pathetic homily about the bond of confidence he had believed to exist between them. Hitler let him know that at the next Reichstag session, he would personally speak words of praise for him. This did not happen, and by June, Fritsch had gone so far as to draft an open letter to every senior general revealing the facts of his acquittal. This may have come to Hitler's ears because all the army and Luftwaffe generals who had heard Hitler's secret Berlin speech on February 5th were ordered to a remote Pomeranian airfield on June 13th, ostensibly to witness a Luftwaffe equipment display. At noon, Hitler arrived, and then the three-hour judgment and findings in the Fritsch trial were read out to them by the tribunal's president. After that, with visible embarrassment, Hitler began to speak, quote, "Gentlemen," he said, "I was the victim of a very regrettable error over General von Fritsch," unquote. He asked them to picture his mental torment caused by the Blomberg affair. In 1936, he said, he had not taken the Schmidt dossier seriously, but after the Blomberg scandal, he had believed anything possible. Quote, "The allegations against General von Fritsch were not malicious fabrications," he insisted. A minor official blundered, that's all, unquote. He had ordered the blackmailer to be shot. More than one general left that airfield with the momentary conviction that Hitler had spoken honestly. Brauchitsch reported the day's events to Fritsch 2 days later. Hitler appointed him to be colonel of his old regiment, but this ancient honor did little to heal the injury. Quote, "Either the Führer sees to it that law and order prevail again in Germany," wrote Fritsch, "and that people like Himmler and Heydrich get their deserts, or he will continue to cover for the misdeeds of these people, in which case I fear for the future. Since the Führer has sanctioned and condoned the way the Gestapo acted in my case, I must regretfully abandon my plan to challenge Himmler to a duel. Besides, after so much time has elapsed, it would probably look somewhat affected. What I cannot, and never will, understand is the Führer's attitude toward me. Perhaps he personally begrudges me that I dented his aura of infallibility by being acquitted." End quote.